Iran's top diplomat says the country is very serious about resolution of outstanding safeguards issues, urging the IAEA to end its baseless accusations against Tehran. The Secretary General of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement says resistance groups remain united in the face of Israel's aggression. Plus, Israel launches fresh missile strikes on Syria, but the country's air defenses intercept most of the projectiles over areas close to the cities of Hama and Tartus. Hello and welcome. Your world news come to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. It's good to have you with us. Top story this hour, Iran's foreign minister has reiterated that the Islamic Republic is serious about reaching a strong and lasting deal, but will not budge on its red lines. We earlier discussed the latest developments and the prospects of the JCPOA revival talks in our news review program. Let's see what our guests had to say.
Iran's foreign minister has called on the UN nuclear watchdog to put an end to Israel's accusations against his country's nuclear activities.
We are in no way ready to allow some political and baseless accusations of the IAEA against Iran to remain as all parties return to the JCPOA. They repeat those claims coming from the Israeli regime whenever they want.
Amir Abdullahian was referring to a recent remark by IAEA Chief Rafael Grossi, who said that Iran needs to provide explanations for traces of enriched uranium at its undeclared sites. This as Tehran is studying the U.S. response to an EU draft text on reviving the 2015 deal. The top Iranian diplomat has reiterated his country's stance, saying Tehran is serious in reaching a strong and lasting deal, but won't budge on its red lines. He said the Islamic Republic will not neglect its people's rights under any circumstances. Meanwhile, Amir Abdullahian told UN Chief Antonio Guterres in a phone call that it's time for all parties to the JCPOA to prove their will in action. David Yagubian, professor of history at the California State University, joining us from San Bernardino, and Frank Emspach, emeritus professor, University of Wisconsin, joining us from Madison, United States. Thanks to the both of you gentlemen for joining us. First of all, David, this question is for you. Why does the IAEA insist on repeating Israel's anti-Iran accusations while the agency's frequent inspections have proven such accusations to be false?
Well, unfortunately, this issue, the IAEA safeguards issue that we're still unfortunately talking about, is completely politically motivated. It's based on fabricated evidence provided by the apartheid state of Israel to the IAEA, completely bogus and laughable evidence, by the way. But to serve the purpose of derailing further the agreement that is the JCPOA in 2018. Furthermore, in 2015, with the signing of the JCPOA, the past military dimensions, PMD as they refer to them, of Iran's civilian nuclear program, that file was closed by the IAEA, and the IAEA head then, Amano, signed off on this, and the Board of Governors signed off on this. So basically, this is completely politically motivated, and we'll see the extent to which the United States is willing to pursue its interests in conforming to international law and returning to the agreement over the interests of the rogue apartheid state of Israel.
Okay, Frank, over to you. Iran urges the U.S. to be serious about its commitments under the JCPOA. What do you think has been the obstacle for Washington so far if it really seeks a lasting deal with Iran, as it claims?
I think there are two obstacles. First of all, you have an extremely active and powerful Israel lobby that has been consistent in their opposition to this. They said so in the paper, I guess, yesterday or today, depending on which day we're looking at, that the agreement was flawed, it was no good, it was a danger to Israel, and that Israel would not allow Iran to become a nuclear state, which is basically a threat of war. At the same time, you have a section of the American ruling class that has never accepted Iran as an independent state, starting from when we helped overthrow the Iranian government in 1953. So you have a group of people who have been fighting tooth and nail to prevent any agreement. And so you have that group now. Now, the interesting thing here is that Biden appears to be willing to go ahead. So far, the signals from Washington, as far as you can determine reading the tea leaves in the paper, are that they have appeared to have responded in a positive way to the issues that Iran has raised. And instead of having a front page article from the Israelis claiming that this was a disaster, it was, I think, on page 16 of the New York Times. So these are like reading the Kremlin stuff from 1955, you know. But still, I think the United States is going forward. And I believe that it is trying to say, the administration is trying to say, that we have interests in the United States that are a little different from Israel. And if they really go forward with this, that would be a sort of an amazing thing, given the real split in politics in this country.
David, back to you. Iran says if the JCPOA is to be restored, outstanding issues related to the safeguards agreement must be resolved first, thus putting an end to anti-Tehran accusations. What's your take on this?
Clearly, this, as I mentioned, is an issue that is politically motivated. It is being articulated as being relevant to the NPT and not necessarily to the JCPOA. But this is just malarkey. It is clearly an issue that has been generated, manufactured by the apartheid state of Israel to derail the JCPOA. And hopefully the American negotiating team isn't going to fall into or continue to be bound within the Zionist trap and will make its own decisions based on what will be best for the United States, what will be best for Europe. And I'd say especially in the context of current international landscape in which the United States has created several crises simultaneously for itself and for Europe, especially by way of its illegal, draconian, extraterritorial sanctions. And so it's time for the United States to come back into the deal and hopefully not once again heed the interests of the apartheid state of Israel.
David, finally, just give us a yes or no. Do you think the nuclear deal will be revived?
I do. At this point, I do. I was very pessimistic over the past several years, but thankfully, I'm feeling very optimistic today. So let's hope that it goes that way.
Okay. And Frank, what do you think? Do you think it will be revived, the nuclear deal?
Yes, because some of the progressives won in these primaries. Not everybody, but most. And so it's no longer a monolithic thing within the Democratic Party that everybody is going to go support Israel here 100%. And so I think there is a real chance to move forward.
Absolutely. Many thanks to the both of you gentlemen for joining our show. It's been a pleasure hosting you in our program. Thank you very much for joining us and for sharing your insights with us. Thank you very much, gentlemen. And on that note, we've come to the end of this news review program.
Iran is conducting massive drone drills. The maneuvers send a strong message to Iran's enemies, not least Israel, who contemplate military action against the Islamic Republic. And as a drone manufacturer, this is also significant since it shows Iran is prepared to sell its drones to its allies. And Washington is not okay with that.
The army of the Islamic Republic of Iran has staged a massive drill which features scores of cutting-edge reconnaissance and combat drone. The drill covers the strategic waters of the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman, as well as the country's central regions. Over 150 new advanced drones are flown in the drill. The Army's 1401 joint drone exercise involves units from the Ground Force, Navy, Air Force, and Air Defense Force. The units have already carried out their intelligence gathering and patrol missions. They include homegrown Yasser, Sadegh, Yazdan and Ababil, three tactical surveillance unmanned aerial vehicles. Pelican vertical takeoff and landing naval drone, as well as Muhajir 6, were also flown from different bases. Muhajir 6 is an ISTAR drone, which means the drone can operate intelligence, surveillance, target acquisition, and reconnaissance missions. It can significantly boost Iran's capability in confronting threats. The drill features the Army's latest achievements in drone engineering and production. Due to the expansion of unmanned aerial capabilities, execution of various and numerous drone missions, and the need to coordinate such flights, the Army has set up a command and control network for the drone operations. The exercise exhibits only a small fraction of the achievements made by the Islamic Republic of Iran's army.
Iran has, for some time now, shown that it is a world leader in drone technology, both in terms of indigenous capabilities developed by Iranian industries and the reverse engineering that Iran has done off of some of the United States frontline drones, which Iran has acquired one way or another. But it's not just the technology, it's how it's adapted for the modern battlefield.
Iran's advancements came to the fore in March when it unveiled an underground drone base. Back then, military officials stated that 60 drones could fly out of the base at the same time. Now, Iran says the ongoing drills exhibit only a small fraction of the progress the army has made in mastering the drone technology.
This is the first time that a joint drone exercise is conducted at the level of the four forces of the Islamic Republic of Iran's army and the country's joint air defense base. Iranian military experts and technicians have in recent years made substantial headways in manufacturing a broad range of indigenous equipment, making the armed forces self-sufficient in the armed sphere. Iran says it has become an exporter of military drones in the world, and that the country holds the upper hand in aerospace. Back in July, when U.S. President Joe Biden was visiting the West Asia region, Iran's army unveiled its first division of ships and submarines capable of carrying armed drones. Earlier this year, Iran's new combat drone called Gaza successfully passed flight tests and became fully operational. The vehicle has a 21-meter wingspan and a 3,100-kilogram takeoff mass with the capability of carrying a payload of 500 kilograms. And before that, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps unveiled one of its new kamikaze drones, dubbed Mirage 504, which is specialized in attacking enemies' defense systems. The Islamic Republic's military doctrine holds that the country's armed capability solely serves defensive purposes and poses no threat to other states.
The Secretary General of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement says resistance groups remain united in the face of Israel's aggression.
The jihad movement specifically, and Hamas and other resistance factions were a supportive ground for this backing, and they also were observing the movement of Saraya al-Quds and the Islamic Jihad in its face-off with the enemy, and our unity is based on a united operations room, and we together are united as one in the face of the enemy and the face of any aggression.
Ziad al-Nakhal said Palestinians will continue to defend their cause and will spare no effort to liberate their land from the Israeli occupation. He condemned desecration of the Palestinian holy sites by Israeli forces and settlers. Nakhala said the Palestinians are determined to end the violations of their sanctities by the regime. Syria says it's once again thwarted Israeli aerial strikes targeting the vicinity of the cities of Hama and Tartus. Military sources say Syria's air defenses intercepted most of Israeli missiles before they could reach their targets. The missiles were fired from the direction of the sea. Sources, however, say the Israeli aggression led to the injury of 2 civilians, material losses, and the outbreak of fires in some places. Tartus, a city on the Mediterranean coast, was also targeted by Israel last week. The regime frequently carries out missile strikes on Syria. Damascus has time and again warned against the aggression and has lodged official complaints with the UN and other international bodies. This week, British Prime Minister has visited the Ukrainian capital, Kiev, for talks with the country's president during the ongoing war with Russia. While Boris Johnson was cheered as a hero by Ukrainians, Johnson himself has made it clear that British taxpayers are going to continue paying the cost of the UK's support for Ukraine. This has raised fears for low-income households who are already struggling to cope. Here's Robert Carter with more.
The outgoing British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has paid what could be his last visit to Ukraine as Premier, meeting with President Volodymyr Zelensky in Ukraine's capital, Kiev, on Wednesday. Boris was hailed for his relentless support for Ukraine's war effort. He was even given a medal for his services. In the midst of ceremonies and handshakes, Johnson, however, reminded his fellow countrymen that there will be more economic hardships to come.
We also know that if we're paying in our energy bills for the evils of Vladimir Putin, the people of Ukraine are paying in their blood. And that's why we know we must stay the course.
Following the NATO-inspired conflict in Ukraine, Britain has pushed a hardline policy of arming the Ukrainians and sanctioning Russia. The result has been catastrophic on the British economy, further exacerbating a cost-of-living crisis and raising fuel prices to eye-watering levels.
Boris Johnson is completely out of touch with reality. This millionaire prime minister is telling the British people that they're going to have to continue to tighten the belts. He's presided over probably the worst cost of living crisis in living memory, which has been precipitated in large measure by Boris Johnson and his government support for a war in Ukraine, which could have quite easily been avoided. Energy bills have already doubled, or certainly gone up by well over 50%. We're being told by the energy regulator that the cap on energy bills is going to be increased still further. Already we have food banks in every town and city in this country because people can't afford to eat. Now we're going to, it looks like, have to set up in the voluntary sector kind of warm banks, I suppose, where people will be looking to go to community centres to keep warm. This is an absolute outrage.
Despite the hardships, Johnson's comments have made it perfectly clear that costs will continue to rise even after he leaves Downing Street. And British taxpayers are going to have to pay the price.
Boris may be enjoying the reputation he's built up for himself inside Ukraine, a country now left devastated by the war. However, his popularity at home may take another dive as the winter months rapidly approach and families will inevitably struggle to heat their homes and feed their loved ones this Christmas. Robert Carter, London.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. According to a recent finding, 24% of sewage overflow pipes at popular seaside resorts in England and Wales have monitors that are faulty or do not have monitors at all, meaning people could be swimming in human waste this summer without realising it. We have prepared for you an article written jointly by Pippa Crera and Helena Horton. The piece is titled, Liz Truss Has Sewage on Her Hands Over UK Environment Agency Cuts. The Guardian can reveal the UK Tory leadership frontrunner Liz Truss was responsible for cutting millions of pounds of funding earmarked for tackling water pollution during her time as Environment Secretary. Liz Truss, who was in charge of the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, DEFRA, between 2014 and 2016, oversaw efficiency plans set out in the 2015 spending review to reduce Environment Agency funding by £235 million. According to the National Audit Office, this included a £24 million cut from a government grant for environment protection, including surveillance of water companies to prevent the dumping of raw sewage between 2014 and 2015 and 2016 and 2017. It represents almost a quarter of the funding cut from this area between 2010, when the grant stood at £120 million, and 2020, by which time the grant had fallen to £40 million. Labour analysis of official figures shows that since 2016, raw sewage discharge in England and Wales has more than doubled, from 14.7 spill events and overflow to 29.3 in 2021. Greenpeace said the figures showed Liz Truss had sewage on her hands. The Environment Agency has called for the British government to reverse the cuts, but campaigners want the next Prime Minister to go even further and also give the body the power to properly monitor water companies over sewage, rather than allowing them to self-report sewage discharges. It follows the finding that 24% of sewage overflow pipes at popular seaside resorts in England and Wales have monitors that are either faulty or do not have monitors at all, meaning people could be swimming in human waste this summer without even realising it. Last year, the head of the Environment Agency, James Bevan, called on the British government to reinstate the funds, saying that given the length of the country's river systems, having only a few hundred people to oversee them is pretty a tall ask. James Bevan told MPs, "It has had an effect on our capacity to monitor, to enforce the rules and to help improve the environment where we think it needs doing. Honestly, I would like to see that grant restored. I would like to get back to where we were 10 years ago, and I think it would make a massive difference." In response to the findings, the Shadow Environment Secretary, Jim McMahon, said, "The country is facing a crisis in our water supply. Our water infrastructure is at bursting point, with billions of litres of water being wasted every day and raw sewage being dumped into our waters." Jim McMahon added, "The fact that Liz Truss was the one to cut the Environment Agency so severely not only demonstrates her lack of foresight, but also her lack of care for the detail in recognising the need to adapt to the serious flooding that has just happened on her watch." Environment Agency insiders said that after Liz Truss's cuts, staff were moved away from environment monitoring towards flood protection, and the number of samples taken from rivers went down dramatically. Rogan Lewis, a senior consultant for Environment Agency, told The Guardian, "They plummeted to the point it was impossible for the agency to know what's going on. They had no control or monitoring capability that was meaningful. They ceded the control of monitoring to water companies, which ended up being able to mark their own homework. They take their own samples and assess whether they are being compliant." Bogan Lewis added, "We saw that doesn't work. Look what happened with Southern Water, which didn't declare its pollution incidents and ended up being fined by the Environment Agency when they were found out. There are suspicions this could be happening across the board. It has been left to citizen scientists who monitor and fill in the gaps." Bogan Lewis added, "Lots of this would have happened under Liz Truss. She was there when some of those cuts were made. She was a poor minister and the Environment Agency has been cut to the bone and it can't monitor or regulate effectively." As Environment Secretary, Liz Truss defended the cuts by claiming, "There are ways we can make savings as a department," citing better use of technology and interagency working. She is already facing questions about why she was registered absent from a vote on a Labour amendment in the House of Commons that aimed to place legal obligations on water companies to stop polluting England's waterways during heavy rainfall. Greenpeace UK's chief scientist, Dr. Doug Parr, said, "A decade of budget cuts and government deregulation has left the Environment Agency almost literally up sewage creek without a paddle. The growing tsunami of sewage unleashed onto Britain's waterways is a shocking demonstration of how undermining our regulators leads to a disregard for nature and those meant to protect it." Dr. Doug Parr added that our likely future Prime Minister was an instigator of cuts to the money used to protect our rivers and so helped cause this environmental catastrophe doesn't bode well for Britain's protection of the natural world. Liz Truss has sewage on her hands. Hugo Tagon, the chief executive of Surfers Against Sewage, said, "Self-monitoring has clearly failed for the water industry. The culture of self-reporting has clearly failed. Millions of hours of sewage pollution going into our waterways every year. It's a failed model." Martin Salter from the Angling Trust said, "The consequences of these ill-advised cuts to the Environment Agency's pollution monitoring capabilities are now present for all to see and smell. With raw sewage flowing down our rivers and dead fish and other wildlife washed up under banks of rivers with depressing regularity." Martin Salter added, "The move away from tougher regulation in favour of allowing water companies to report on their own failures has created a polluter's charter, as evidenced by the recent prosecution of Southern Water for deliberately falsifying their discharge data. The Environment Agency has long bemoaned its lack of funding and its lack of power, underpinned by a lack of ambition from ministers on tackling waste. In 2020, it said it recognised that a huge gap is opening up between the outcomes that they want to achieve and their ability to achieve them, and estimated that at the current rate of progress, it would take more than 200 years to reach the government's target of at least 75% of waters being close to their natural state."
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Muslim Lady. I'm your host, Zainab Askari. Well, we have heard about the events of Karbala and women who had played important role in it. But there's a question that whether women before the moment of Karbala, were there women during the Karbala, we know that, but were there women post-Karbala and what was their role? We got to talk about all that in our studio with Siddiqa. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, and thank you for having me today. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Siddiqa. Thank you so much for accepting the invitation. A very warm welcome.
Thank you.
All right, so we had been discussing about the role of women post-Karbala. And Siddiqa, as you said, there were so many women who played their role, be that before Karbala, in Karbala, and post-Karbala. You highlighted women about whom there's not much written in the history. But thank you so much. You told us about their roles, the indirect support. And there's Lady Zainab, salamu alayha. You said in previous session that her role is so extensive, so I told you, let's discuss that in another session. So yes, I would want you to start with that.
Yes, Hazrat Zainab alayhi salam, there are books written about her. And one of the books that I have read and sort of my information in this session is from that particular book, is written by an author, Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Kazim Qazwini. He is actually buried in Karbala. Now, he's written his book about Hazrat Zainab alayhi salam in Arabic, but roughly translates to Hazrat Zainab from cradle to grave. It's a whole history about her life, and he focuses extensively on what her role was.
Okay.
You know, Hazrat Zainab's life is not known much to the common people,
yeah.
Right? Because we only recognize her as someone in Karbala. But what people know less is that when she was in Kufa with her father,
yeah.
Imam Ali alayhi salam was the caliph of the time, and his seat of caliphate was moved to Kufa,
mm-hmm.
She used to give tafsir classes in Kufa. She used to invite the women to the house and educate them on the Quran.
As Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says about her, she's an alima without a mu'allim. She's a teacher without...
Who has not been formally taught.
Yeah.
But her knowledge is from divine guidance.
True.
So when she's giving a Quran tafsir classes, we can be definitely sure that she has been given her education from the source itself.
True.
From the source of all knowledge. And this indicates the spiritual level that she had. And over here, I'd like to put in a small point. Ayatollah Langrudi, people don't know him, but he was a very, very great scholar in his own time. He's passed away. Ayatollah Langrudi, in one of his lectures, he had a series of lectures he had delivered in Farsi, in Qom, I believe. I had heard those lectures quite some time back, and he says every child born from Imam Ali and Hazrat Fatima had the ability to become an imam.
Okay.
And therefore Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein were both imams. Hazrat Zainab had that spiritual status that could allow her to access divine knowledge,
yeah.
Which she then used to spread the message in different places.
True.
And we'll see later on how she did it. So Hazrat Zainab in Kufa has classes. Now Imam Ali has been killed, martyred. She's back in Medina with her brothers.
Yeah.
Imam Hassan dies. Imam Hussein is there. Imam Hussein is now leaving Medina. She goes with him. He's in Mecca. They go to Mecca, then they head towards Kufa.
Yeah.
When they're leaving Mecca, now she's married to her cousin. Her cousin brings their two sons to accompany Imam Hussein and help him, On and Muhammad.
Okay.
Now we know the two sons of Imam Hussein, the two sons of Hazrat Zainab alayhi salam,
yeah.
Accompany Imam Hussein. And she gives up these two children on the day of Ashura in the way of Imam Hussein. She sends them both to the battle to fight for Imam Hussein. Both of them are killed.
Both the sons who are young, On and Muhammad, get killed in the way of Islam,
yes.
Supporting Imam Hussein and Islam. I'll discuss more on that with you after a short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned to IRIP English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Hello, Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Muslim Lady. I'm with Sadiqa and we're discussing about the role of Lady Zainab Salamu Alaiha in Karbala. Yes.
Now, obviously, her role, her actual role in the movement starts once Imam Hussein has been martyred. Imam Hussein, before he leaves for the battle, he gives her his will to protect the Imam, to protect the children. Whenever they would try and whip the children, she would put herself in the firing line to comply with the will of Imam Hussein of protecting the children.
All right.
Now they move towards Kufa. In Kufa, she's kept outside. The people surround them. And she looks at the people of Kufa. These are the same people who invited Imam Hussein. And now they're weeping, seeing the family of the Prophet in this degraded state. At that point, she wants to give a sermon. Now, there's a lot of noise in the bazaar. She wants to give a sermon. So she says one word, stop. And it seems that she has this wilayat taqwini, this power in her, that everything would stop at her command. It is said that the bells on the camels stopped in the midst.
All right.
The breaths stopped. Mm-hmm. That means she had control over everything around her. The spiritual status that she had allowed her to control the events around her, the environment around her, such that the bells of the camel stopped, the breaths of the people stopped, and everyone kept quiet. And then she starts her sermon. Her sermon has been translated into English. It is available in this book, Nafasul Mahmum, which was written by Sheikh Abbas Qummi, but it has been translated into English.
Yeah.
Easily available on Google. Just Google Nafasul Mahmum and you can easily access it. It's a very detailed sermon where she starts to highlight to people of Kufa what they did and how they betrayed. And she mentions it. You didn't only betray my brother. You have a history of betrayal.
All right.
You betrayed my father. You betrayed my brother, now you betrayed Imam Hussein. And your betrayal this time has had consequences that have led to the son of the messenger being murdered with his companions and then his women degraded. And yet you cry over here, weep, because you deserve to weep.
All right.
And this, and it's a very lengthy sermon. I think if translated into English, it comes to about 3-4 pages.
Yeah.
And I would recommend a lot of people, obviously we cannot discuss 3-4 pages in the span of a few minutes.
True. Yeah.
But those who do have the chance, Google the sermon and you will see how she compliments her mother's sermon in Medina.
I had written a poem about her, but since you referred to the sermon, I would read the line I wrote regarding this sermon. Zainab is truly Zainab, the one who glorifies her father, who split apart the chests of Kufa, her sermons reflecting the tone of Ali, to rekindle 1,000 withered and dead hearts, many.
MashaAllah.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Muslim Lady and we're talking about the role of Lady Zainab Salamu Alaiha. Before the break, I mentioned a few lines in my poem. Now, there are a few more lines when she was in the court of Yazid. Before I ask you what she did over there, I would like to read these lines.
Please.
Zainab is truly Zainab, for she manifested the courage of Ali, won wars of pride without a battle, calling captors as her freed captives, breaking Yazid's Khaybar in one strong jolt, as Ali broke Khaybar in one strong jolt. Yes, Sadiqa.
MashaAllah, that was amazing for you. But yes, after Kufa, Kufa was where Ibn Ziyad was seated. He was the minister. He was that the one appointed by Yazid to rule over Kufa. Ibn Ziyad now sends the women to Yazid in Sham, which is today known as Damascus. Hazrat Zainab and the women, you know, they head towards Damascus. On the way, they lose a few children. She would stop the caravan, go collect the children. You know, it is said through this whole journey, she had become so weak, because the Yazid's army would give them very little food to survive with. One piece of bread a day with a bit of water. But because the children were so hungry, she would forego her food for 2-3 days and let the children eat her food. And this is how she continuously looked after them. Now they reach Yazid's court. In Yazid's court, first Yazid had one of his friends, who was not a Muslim actually, he's seated next to him. Now with them, with Hazrat Zainab was Fatima Sughra, who we mentioned before.
Yeah.
Daughter of Imam Hussein was very beautiful. It is said that that man told Yazid, give her to me. He thought they're captives. So he said, give her to me as a slave. Yazid is going to give. Fatima gets very scared. She goes to Hazrat Zainab. She sticks onto her. She clings onto her. She's like, I don't want to be taken in slavery. Now Hazrat Zainab, through the knowledge that she had and the fact that Imam Hussein had also told her, you will never see degradation. You're never going to be degraded. Whatever they do to you, your honor is always going to remain intact. She tells Yazid, by Allah, you do not have the courage to do this. He says, I will do it. He says, no, you will not do it. And she says a few words to him. He feels ashamed. He keeps quiet. That man who's sitting next to Yazid,
yeah.
He repeats his request. I want this daughter as a slave. Okay. Yazid tells him, go die. I'm not going to give her to you. Because he's embarrassed by what Hazrat Zainab says. Over here, she plays the role of protecting the children of Imam Hussein from being taken into slavery.
Yeah.
And she relies on her divine knowledge and also the fact that Imam Hussein has told her, your honor is never going to be lost. Then we see they try to kill Imam Sajjad. And again, she says, if you try to touch him,
yeah,
you're going to have to go past me first. And again, over here, she delivers a sermon. According to the author I mentioned first, Sayyid Muhammad Kadhim Ghazwini, he mentions a very interesting fact. He says, Imam Sajjad, we don't hear too much from him. And the reason Hazrat Zainab kept on giving the sermons, still Yazid's court everywhere while Imam Sajjad was quiet, so she could keep him safe until they reach Yazid's court and where Imam Sajjad is now able to fully open up. And then he can give his sermon, which then leads to the people understanding the reality of Yazid. Therefore, her role in protecting the Imam, the Bani Hashim, the people of Imam Hussein, leads to a place where Imam Sajjad is now able to openly discuss what happened.
And make people realize what was the reality, who were being told lies over lies, that who they are, they're against Islam, they have left Islam, and all those fake stories. Now the realities come in. That's it. That's how women can play important roles. Inshallah, I'll discuss more about the role of women with you in coming sessions. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Who is the love one?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity.
La ilaha illallah.
Muhammadur Rasulullah.
Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, so Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A flagrantly racist and violent ex-cop is bringing national attention to a small town in Mississippi where black residents say they were systematically terrorized by police and the court system. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Mike Ludwig, journalist. This article is published under the heading Mississippi Town Hired Racist Cop to Terrorize Black Residents, Advocates Say. Here's more. A flagrantly racist and violent ex-cop is bringing national attention to a small town in Mississippi where black residents say they were systematically terrorized by police and the court system. Civil rights advocates condemn the officers' actions and say they are a symptom of a larger problem that extends far beyond one rural community and a bad apple among the local police. A lawsuit filed in federal court this week claims white police in the rural, majority black town of Lexington, Mississippi, targeted black residents and subjected them to false arrest, brutality, excessive fines, and unreasonable searches. The department's discriminatory intent was made clear by the leaked recording of Sam Dobbins, the former police chief, hurling racist and homophobic slurs and bragging about killing 13 people as an officer. The lawsuit argues, in the recording, Dobbins releases the idea that residents fear him. Dobbins made national headlines after a black officer secretly recorded 17 minutes of audio capturing his former boss repeatedly using words while boasting about police brutality. Dobbins patrolled the streets of Lexington with impunity despite a well-known history of harassment, racist remarks, and allegations that he jailed a man on bong charges while working for a different Mississippi county in 2013 and nearly beat the man to death, according to the Mississippi Center for Investigative Reporting, which first revealed the audio recording. The officer who secretly recorded Dobbins reportedly resigned on July 19th. Local aldermen voted 3-2 to fire Dobbins on July 20th to applause from black residents. However, those residents and activists say the problem of racist policing in Lexington and across the South is much bigger than Dobbins. Jill Colin Jefferson, founder and director of Julian, the Mississippi-based civil rights group that filed the lawsuit, said it's time to shine a light on the ongoing racist abuses in Lexington. Representing several local black plaintiffs, the group is asking a federal judge for a temporary restraining order on Lexington police to protect black residents. Civil rights groups and local plaintiffs are also calling on the Justice Department to investigate, as federal officials have done in larger cities with patterns of racist police abuse, a practice that was temporarily halted under former President Donald Trump before resuming under President Joe Biden. Allegations included in the lawsuit also come from witnesses working for Lexington police, who reported that Dobbins and other officers brutally beat residents after handcuffing them or dragging them out of the back of the patrol cars. There needs to be a formal federal investigation, and not just of the one office or two offices or the police department, but of this entire town, Jefferson said in an interview, adding, "It's really hard to explain to outsiders, but every branch of government in Lexington is corrupt. Every branch of government is controlled by white supremacy." Of Lexington's roughly 1,800 residents, about 85% are black. But former police chief Dobbins, the local prosecutor, the judge, the mayor, and other top officials are all white and politically intertwined with one wealthy white family, according to Jefferson. Catherine Barrett Riley, the city's attorney and a member of the family Jefferson described, did not respond to a request for comment. Despite his checkered past, Dobbins was hired by city officials to control the local black population and boost revenue with fines and legal fees, Jefferson said. Residents reported hundreds of roadblocks set up in the tiny town to target and stop black drivers. Two plaintiffs, both black men, say they were targeted and arrested on bogus charges, including for possessing marijuana that was allegedly planted by police after speaking out about police harassment at a community Know Your Rights meeting earlier this year. Former resident Tassa Walden said she fled Lexington and moved to Memphis, Tennessee, to protect her family from Dobbins, who repeatedly wrote baseless tickets and made repeated excuses to arrest her son without a warrant. Walden's son, who followed her and now lives in Memphis, is one of the several plaintiffs in the lawsuit, which lays out a disturbing pattern of racial profiling, excessive force, and sexual harassment by Lexington police. "It's a nightmare. It's terrible. People are afraid to even walk down the street to go to the store to pay bills, because every time black people come out, it's always a problem," Walden said over the phone recently, adding, "No matter if you ride or if you're walking, it's still a problem, especially the young blacks, the younger generations. It's a problem for them." Black residents filed at least 200 complaints against Dobbins and other officers, despite the threat of retaliation, Jefferson said. But officials failed to act until the recording of Dobbins' racist tirade was released to the public. Even then, two aldermen voted against firing Dobbins. Civil rights groups have said for years that many rural jails in the U.S., often in the South, operate like debaters' prisons that routinely jail people living in low-income communities for failing to pay exorbitant fines and legal fees resulting from minor charges and traffic violations that are used to fill local coffers. Jefferson said such targeting and extortion is exactly how Lexington keeps money flowing into the courthouse and police department while operating in one of the poorest countries in the nation. "It's the good old boy network. This is how this works," Jefferson said, adding, "What's happening in Lexington is not only happening in Lexington. It's also happening in other places across Mississippi and the South." Jefferson, who is black, said Dobbins once blocked her from entering the local courtroom and threatened to arrest the civil rights attorney if she went inside. Jefferson said she called the office of Mississippi Attorney General Lynn Fitch, a Republican, but was told the local courtroom was outside of Fitch's jurisdiction. When asked if racist policing in a Mississippi town would fall under Fitch's statewide jurisdiction, a spokesperson said she would review the lawsuit and added that Fitch's office is unable to comment on ongoing investigations. However, Fitch is currently focused on defending the anti-abortion laws in Mississippi. And recently, it remained unclear whether the Attorney General will take any action on the alleged racist abuse in Lexington. The town replaced Dobbins with an interim police chief, Charles Henderson, who is also named as defendant in the lawsuit and has a nasty reputation in town. Among other crimes and abuses, including threatening to kill a local resident for being outside at night and targeting him for arrest, more than a dozen women have reported that Henderson repositioned them for assaulting and proceeded to ticket or arrest them if they refused, according to the legal complaint. In an email to the Associated Press, Henderson said he is working to move the Lexington police forward and cast doubt on the claims made by residents in the civil rights lawsuit, which he called a defamation of character. Of course, a claim isn't defamation if it's true, and Jefferson says Henderson must also be held to account. She relayed a story about Henderson breaking down an elderly woman's door, blasting her with pepper spray, and then using a fire hose to wash her down at the police station. However, if Henderson believes his character is being defamed in the media and federal court, then a federal investigation would be a good way to expose the truth, Jefferson says. Let's have the Department of Justice come in and look and see what Henderson has come. I would want to see what he has to say to the federal government to show that he did not do the things, Jefferson said, adding, we have a line of people that would go down the street with complaints against Henderson. If he wanted to do that, I would join fight.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.